Hello, and welcome to the Zenith Bank H1 2020 conference call. Throughout the call, all participants will be in listen mode only, and after the initial presentation, you will have the opportunity to engage with the speaker and ask any questions during the session. Just to remind you, this conference call is being recorded. Today, I'm pleased to present Mr. Ebenezer Onyewugu, Group CEO, Zenith Bank. Mr. Ebenezer, please go ahead with your meeting.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is my pleasure to welcome all of you to this conference call, where we'll be able to throw more light regarding our H1 2020 performance. Before we go ahead, I'd like to introduce my colleagues who are on this call with me. I have Mr. Tokwe Fashoranti, Executive Director; Dennis Olise, Executive Director; Henry Oro, Executive Director; Felix Egbon, our Chief Risk Officer; Mukhtar Adam, our CFO; and Taye Ayedebu, our Investor Relations Manager. Once again, it's my pleasure to welcome us to this conference call. The pandemic is still ravaging. The world continues to battle to see how to overcome the pandemic. And in Nigeria, as at yesterday, number of reported cases stood at 55,456. Discharge cases about 43,000. Number of deaths 1,067. It's also interesting to say that Nigeria has moved into the third phase of the easing off of the lockdown, with the regular and scheduled commercial flights in and out of the country. However, the most important thing remains the fact that there is no vaccine yet. So, but one thing is certain, the direction of travel is that of uncertainty, that of pressure, that of contraction. But the more worrisome part is that the duration of travel is unknown. Because the duration of travel is unknown, we cannot tell the kind of curve we face. Whether, obviously, from what you see, it's not a U curve. We can't tell if it's a W curve or it's an L curve. But it's the expectation of everyone that very soon, hopefully before the end of the year, that a vaccine will be found. However, what we've seen so far is that the assumption on which the projections and budgets for 2020 were set have been clearly vanquished by the pandemic. Nobody saw this coming. Nobody planned for this. And we are all in a process where we found ourselves having to contend with the pandemic and riding the storms occasioned by the pandemic. One of the very fundamental fallout of the pandemic is that globally, economies are contracting. Some have gone into recession. We've also seen the global stock market taking very huge hits, except for Shanghai, Shenzhen stock market and S&P 500 that recorded a growth of about, year-to-date growth of about 16.4% and 6% respectively. However, this growth has been driven largely by the tech and e-commerce companies. So we've seen brands rising and remaining dominant, even in the COVID era, but simply because of the fact that they are relying on digital technologies. So accordingly for us in Zenith, we are also deploying a lot of our resources to build competencies and ensure that we deploy a reasonable level of digital competencies and capabilities in our business. One thing is certain for Zenith, the going concern impact assessment of COVID on us is nil. We continue to maintain very strong buffers, very strong liquidity and capital buffers. Therefore, we are in a position to continue to reward our shareholders as we continue to post respectable results. In terms of the key issues in the environment, we've seen very recently CBN reducing interest rate on savings deposits from 3.75 to 1.75. This is expected to impact favorably on the cost of funds between now and end of the year. There is commencement of the sale of foreign exchange to the Bureau de Change. It has also seen rates moderating slightly. CBN recently came up with the destination payment for imports. The real reason behind this is to promote transparency and also ensure that we checkmate the process of capital flight that may have been occasioned with this, the system that existed before. Federal government has also taken a bold step of removing fuel subsidy. Electricity tariff has also been, in a way, partially deregulated. And we've also seen the resumption of flights, commercial flights, in and out of the country. We expect that these initiatives will help the economy to wake up very quickly. It will boost commercial activities, and we also see us getting to the point where we can begin to talk of effective recovery post the pandemic. We have presented the highlights of our report in the documents we have shared to everyone on the call. What our expectation is that as we go through the session, we'll have enough time to take to do the Q&A. So I'd like to once again invite us to this session, and what we'll do very quickly is to go through the Q&A so that we'll have enough time devoted to take your questions. But I'd like to assure you that Zenith is very, very effectively positioned to continue to ride the storms. We have taken initiatives to ensure that asset quality is maintained. We've also ensured that our market share is effectively defended and even improved at this time. So I thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the call once again.
Thank you. If you wish to ask an audio question, you may do so by pressing 01 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing 02 to cancel. Again, it's 01. If you want to ask a question, press so on your telephone keypad. Our first question comes from Jerry Nimbwe from Cardinal Stone. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for the call and also congrats on your results. I just have a number of questions, really. So the first question I have is regarding your fee, income, and expense line. So I understand that, yes, Q2 was kind of weak in terms of activities, and also the impact of bankers' tariff weighed negatively on fee income. But that is not the same kind of story I'm seeing in the fee expense line, because I saw that grew about 74%. So if you could give some kind of clarity regarding the fee expense line, you know, what happened there, the drivers, then that would be helpful. Secondly, on your AMCON levy, so I understand that, yes, by H1, you expected to take the full-year charge. But what happens, you know, for further asset growth in H2? So what do you do? Do you, you know, push that over to the following year or restate the numbers you already have after H1? The third question is regarding your effective CRR. I'd like to know what that number is after H1. And the fourth question is on credit. So how much loans were restructured, especially as a result of the pandemic? So I can see you have about 17.8% after H1, but that's not too different from what we saw, you know, in Q1, about 17.4%. So is it that you're already proactive before the CBN measures came out in terms of loan forbearances to be granted to your customers, or if there are any other issues, you know, that happened during the period, that would be helpful. And finally, if you can speak to your oil and gas portfolio. So I know that upstream oil and gas grew, you know, in H1, despite what we're seeing. So if you can speak to that. And also, I saw a growth in the oil and gas NPL as well, about 40% of, you know, NPL compared to about 30-something percent at that full year. So if you can speak to that, that would be helpful as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think I'll take on the expense line right away. If you look at the expense line we have, in terms of our general overhead, the statutory levy, which comprises mainly AMCON charge and NDIC premium, they constitute 46% of our overheads, operating overheads. But if you are looking at the comprehensive overhead, you have 28%. Unfortunately for us, we have no control over that. Maybe one way to control it is to look at our size, but we have a business to run. We have a size to maintain. We have our liquidity buffers that we must maintain. Therefore, what we continue to drive is what we consider to be optimal in order to keep us relevant and maintain our strategic focus with respect to how we face our business. I think that deals with AMCON levy. The on CRL, the effective CRL, I think I'll leave the CFO to answer that. And the, in terms of the fee income, Tokpef Assurance will answer the question of fee income. Oil and gas, growth in oil and gas loan. The oil and gas loan is basically in their foreign currency denominated, and what you see as the growth is the translation effect of the adjustment in the currency. So as it were, in absolute number, we have not increased in terms of exposure to oil and gas loan. The same equally applies to what you have in the NPL in oil and gas is the fact that we decided to be prudent. As the pandemic broke, what we did was the legacy items we have under the PMS importation that are now being repaid from promissory note, we decided to go on the path of prudence to make full provisions for them so that as we get the promissory note and dematerialize, we can reclassify. So effectively, it's not a deterioration. We could have left them where they were, but we felt that in the light of the COVID, we are looking at the fact that there could be delay in the release of the promissory note. As a result, we decided to make sure that we get full provision for them. So I will leave Tokwe to take on the fee income, then CFO to take on the CRL.
Okay, thank you, sir. Okay, thank you for your question. For the drop in the fees on electronic products, like you rightly said, the major reason, of course, is the revised guide to bank charges. It played a major role in three ways. The first is in the NIP fees that reduced. We know that CBN reduced the fees from 15 naira to a three-tier structure. In the first structure of 10 naira, that's the 0 to 5,000 transactions, we have about 34% of our NIP transactions at that bucket. That reduced effectively the fee by 89% of that first bucket. The second of 25 naira from 50 naira, that's 5,000 to 50,000, that's 47% of our transactions are in that bucket. That reduced our fees by 56%. Of course, the third bucket it stays the same. Secondly, is the ATM fees. We are one of the, we do a lot there. We lost about 46% of our income line there because of the reduction of ATM remote or not transactions from 65 naira to 35 naira. The third is card fees. You know that there was a drop in card fees from 50 naira monthly to 50 naira quarterly. That dropped it from 600 naira annually to 200 naira annually. And of course, you also know that the travel restrictions have reduced a lot of travels. And of course, a lot of earnings from such transactions has come down too. In addition, also, international spend have also been dropped because of FX situations from $36,000 to about $5,000 for us and even for most other banks. So that played a very key role in the massive drop that you can see in the fee income on electronic products. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tokbat. So may I invite the CFO to take on the question on CRL?
Okay, thank you very much for the question. The CRR, we all know the various CRR regimes that we have gone through. At a point, it was part of the CRR was driven by loan-to-deposit ratio. But that happened only up to March. Within the period, we have seen a lot of increase in CRR debits that are more or less at the discretion of the regulators. Okay? So at the end of June, our CRR was around 1.5 trillion. You will see it in our financial statement on page 152. That's the total CRR. If you compare that with our total deposits, Naira deposits, you have about 47% effective CRR as at June. So that's where we are on CRR. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mukta. May I invite the risk officer, Felix Edmore, to speak on the restructured loan.
Good afternoon. On the restructured facilities, as of June, we have commenced a review of the government and intervention loans, beginning to treat them as was advised by regulation. That has brought in to date about 2.75% of our loans restructured in that sector. We do not expect significant contribution from any other sector except oil and gas. And most of what we have in oil and gas are syndication loans. Our discussions are still ongoing with regards to those loans. The impact for us, we don't expect it to be higher than about 3 to 5% when they are concluded.
Okay, thank you very much. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Zulki Zalanka from Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, hi everyone. This is Zulki Zalanka from Renaissance Capital. Thanks for the call. And I have a couple of questions. The first question is, could you perhaps just tell me your thoughts around the AMCON levy? My understanding is it could potentially be reduced to 10 basis points of assets. Is this now in force? And if not, what are the chances of it being implemented? My second question is around how do you calculate your coverage ratio at 132%? Because when I look at your numbers, as at half year, you still have very little in regulatory risk reserves. So your coverage numbers I calculate should actually be around 84%. You know, so correct me where I'm wrong. Then my third and final question is, your stage two book has actually tripled year to date. So could you perhaps spend some time talking about what are the major loans you have in stage two? What sort of issues are they having? And how do you think about the adequacy of your coverage ratio for your stage two book? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for these questions. The AMCON one is indeed very interesting. We'll be happy to have a regime where the levy is now pegged at about 10% of total assets. Because if you look at our P&L, what we paid this year was about 30 billion. So if you imagine the burden on us, our expectation will be that as we start getting close to the terminal date of the AMCON, that's AMCON, whether there is a renewal of the tenor or not, our expectation is to see a dispensation that will bring about a reduction in terms of the expense burden on us. The second part, even though you didn't raise that, closely related to that is on NDIC premium. Now, the CFO just mentioned what our CRR is. The position we've had, we've continued to advocate, even in the Bankers Committee, is that funds held in CRR can be classified as safe and secured, therefore do not require any insurance policy. But to date, the provision of the Act is such that you pay AMCON premium on your total Naira deposit. So if part of my Naira deposit is held securely and safe, in the safest place ever you can think of in the country, with the central bank, why should I pay a premium? So we expect advocacy from everyone to see that, yes, it makes sense for us to see a dispensation where not AMCON levy is reduced not on the total asset of a bank, maybe a percentage, and also the NDIC premium, the portion of your CRR held in CBN being excluded from payment of premium. If that happens, we'll be quite pleased with it. So, unfortunately, it's not within our control as to what will happen, but if you are asking our expectation, these are things that we'll certainly be very positive about. In terms of the coverage ratio, I will leave the CFO to speak to that, as well as the stage two bucket.
Okay, thank you very much. You asked about the coverage ratio. The coverage ratio is your total impairment that you have on your balance sheet, which is 174 billion. If you look at page 155 of the financials, and then you compare that with our NPL. Our NPL is 132 billion. So if you do the math, you will have the coverage ratio that we have. That's number one. You have to be very careful not to assume the state 3 loan is the NPL. We have disclosed the NPL separately and we have disclosed the state 3 loan separately. So if you do that math, you are going to have that. Because of that, you will not expect to have a regulatory risk reserve, because our total ECL provision is higher than our total NGAAP provision. So take note of that. Then you're talking of stage 2 loans. Why have stage 2 loans grown? That's very interesting. You know that stage 2 loan is in between stage 1 and stage 3. What moves a loan from stage 1 to stage 2 is when there is increased risk on either an industry, the operating environment, or a customer. And you and I know that within this COVID era, with all what is happening in the world, there is increased risk, even if not for any specific customer, for the overall operating environment and for specific industry. So that will naturally make you migrate some of the loans from stage 1 to stage 2. Not only that, it would also, even the loans that are in stage 1, if you do your forward-looking data very well, because the ECL is a forward-looking, you will know that the percentage provision for each of the stages have to be higher than normal. So that's what has increased the amount in stage 2. Some of them have moved from stage 1. And the coverage is reasonably well for us. We have the coverage for stage 2 is above 10%. And the coverage from stage 1 has increased from 1 or below 1% to 3%, just for us to account for the elevated risk environment we are facing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mukhtar. Yes. Let me further add here that as we race towards the end of the year, we expect improvements in terms of our NPL and impairment as well. This is because part of what we have, the new NPLs we added for half year. As we speak, the ones relating to the PMS import will receive and dematerialize the promissory note, and by the time we apply the credits, these items will be declassified. There's also a company involved in the transport sector where, because of the COVID, we took a very, very prudent measure to go and to provide for it. But as we speak now, all the accumulated and past due obligation on the accounts that made them to be classified have been cleared. So by the time we take all that into consideration, we are going to have close to 30 billion in NPL being declassified. So when we put all this into consideration, and given the fact that we don't expect further deterioration in terms of our asset quality, we expect improvement in terms of the coverage ratio, and also to post a much stronger NPL ratio by the end of the year. Can we take the next question?
Hi, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah, hi, I just had, so on your point about the Ampton levy, so when is the actual, I guess, technical termination date by law for AMCON? And, you know, just still on the adequacy of provisioning, so it's good to know that you have a bunch of big loans that could potentially get reclassified as, you know, I guess stage 2 or stage 1. But Mukhtar's point about the 10% coverage for stage 2, how do you get this? Is this for the bank? Because for group, the coverage is 3%. And it's down from 9% in December. So I'm just wondering how, you know, what numbers you are quoting.
Okay, thank you very much. For AMCON, it will be very good and helpful for the industry if we can get a lot more advocacy on what applies as the tenor of AMCON comes to an end. As a matter of fact, you'll recall that the tenor was for 10 years, and that 10-year period will be running out by end of next year. But what happens subsequently is not within the hands of the players in the industry, but if it's renewed and it comes with a review of the dynamics of the payment of the levy, it will be very interesting. For as long as is not so onerous and burdensome on banks. If you look at an institution like Zenith, given our size, we pay by share size. But if you look at the amount of loan taken over from us by Ancom, if you aggregate the levies we paid, we've more than recovered that. So, in other words, we are helping to sustain the industry. We don't mind doing that, but we appreciate going forward if it's done in such a manner that it doesn't remain a heavy burden. 30 billion in this dispensation to pay in 1 year is a lot. It is a lot. So on the issue of the coverage, I think Mukhtar will throw more light on it regarding the further analysis and review you want to see.
Okay, thank you. So the coverage for the group, stage 1 is 3%, stage 2 is 3%, and stage 3 is 50%.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Just as a reminder, if you wish to ask a question to the board members, you may do so by pressing 01 on your telephone keypad. Again, it's 01 on your telephone keypad if you wish to ask a question. If you wish to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing 02 to cancel. Our next question comes from Gardea from EFG Hermes. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Ronak Gardia from EFG Hermes. Thanks for taking my question. My question really is just around your trading income. Could you provide a bit of granularity on that line item? Specifically, could you just break it down in terms of, you know, how much of that is realized, how much of it is unrealized, what's coming from the swaps and what's coming from, you know, just the generic investment securities portfolio? And also, as a sort of a related question to that, we can see what the gross income for this line item is. Could the management just highlight, you know, what the net impact, net profit from this is? You know, once you take into consideration the various various borrowings that the bank has to take in order to generate that income. And finally, just on that. Could management speak towards, you know, the sustainability of this line item maybe in the second half of this year and going into 2021? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Before I get the CFO to speak and throw more light on it, I think one thing we need to let the investors and the analysts know is that Zenith has a very profound treasury management. And without sounding immodest, I think I'll say we're one of the best in the market. And we read the market, we have strong buffers, and within this period, we've seen a lot of volatility. The smartest of treasurers trade on volatilities. So that is part of what we do. You know, the skills we have there, they are quite strong and quite sophisticated. And as a result, we are able to really play the market. So I'll leave the CFO to throw more light in terms of how the numbers are going and the sustainability as we race towards the end of the year.
Okay, thank you very much for the question. Okay, so you are asking about the trading income. If you look at page 149, you would have disclosure of our trading gains. First, you have derivative, which is a loss of 13.5, treasury bills and trading income, profit of 65.6, bonds and trading income, profit of 5.2, interest income on trading bonds, you have 1.4 billion, totaling 58.8 billion for the group. You ask whether this is, which part of it is realized and unrealized. You have to know that for a trading book, there is no distinction between realized and unrealized because you value the trading book at any point in time. You can talk about realized and unrealized when you are looking at the banking book. So a trading book, you do a valuation. So that is the value of the trading book and the profit coming from the trading book as of June 2020. The following day, you will do revaluation. If any of them has gone up or down, you adjust. So if I have to choose between whether it is, which part of it is realized or unrealized, everything there is realized because that is the true value. That is how much you can sell, you can realize from that instrument on that day, 30th June 2020. That, and then sustainability of their trading book. We have been having trading gains for more than 5 years now, and it has been consistent. Yes, the amount and the quantum has been fluctuating. So trading, derivatives and swaps are products, financial products that have been there for decades. Banks have been trading on it, companies have been trading on it, and it's not going to go away. If we are, we have a very good treasury, and we know how to read the market, and once we read the market and we have the resources to play properly, we are able to make the necessary gain. So we will sustain it as much as the environment and the market conditions allow us to safely play in that market and make our gains. That's what I want to say on that.
Okay.
Now that's just as a couple of follow-ups on that. So you say the trading bills income is you know, it could be realized, it could be unrealized. On that basis, if the yields were to reverse suddenly tomorrow or over the next few months, is there a possibility that this yield, this trading income gain could quite easily reverse? To the same extent, and you know, regarding your derivatives, could you just maybe give some breakdown in terms of what percentage, you know, how much do you have in swaps, how much do you have in forwards, and you know, what would happen to that portfolio if there was a devaluation of the naira? Would we see a similar loss to what we're seeing, what we saw in the first half? And lastly, I guess the sustainability question, like you rightly mentioned, you know, derivatives, swaps, they have been here for a while. But if you look at Zenith, it's really only increased since 2016, 2017. Before that, you know, it was much less. So, you know, I guess the question there is, you know, what's really different in the last 3 years that Zenith was doing? That Zenith wasn't doing before, and that therefore allows the bank to sustain trading income at this level.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll get Mukhtar, the CFO, to speak on it, but one thing is certain, market is never static. And even when you see one upheaval in the market, in a way, if you read it, it throws up a new opportunity or a new segment or a new niche. And we don't see market as a closed circuit kind of arrangement. So whatever it is that we see in the market, we read it and follow the trend. Yes, if there is a reversal in terms of yield, what happens? We have to look at in totality, look at the narratives around whatever is driving the trend in the market. Once we read it and understand, then we know how to make the next move to cushion whatever variability we expect in terms of our returns. So that's where the skills come in. So as a result, at the end of the day, we are able to even out certain volatilities that will normally come up in the course of trading. So I'll leave the CFO to throw more light on the other issues you raised.
Okay, thank you. The breakdown, if you look at page 154, we have shown the nominal amount of forward and swap contracts. We have also shown the nominal amount of our futures. But to say what's the size of our swap book, our swap book is about 1.5 billion, as I drew thereabout. Then if you are talking of reversing the trading bills income, so you are talking of valuation. You don't just reverse. When you are valuing based on parameters. One of the parameters is exchange rate, interest rate, and the trend and what you have forecast. So there are so many things that go into doing a valuation. When you now have the new value, then whether you are going to take adjustment upward or downwards will be determined. So it's not just you wake up tomorrow and then you have to reverse income. So if the market is going differently, That's why your traders will read. If they read the market very well, which they are doing very, very well, they will know when to sell off something to avoid taking loss. And once they do that, you will not get to the point that you are going to reverse a lot or significant part of the gains or income. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Can we take the next question?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tomasi Wamdu from ABSA. Please go ahead with your question.
Thank you very much for hosting the call. Just a few questions. On your oil and gas loan book, I believe you mentioned that this was largely due to the FX movement. So I just wanted to get a sense of, is this in the upstream or is this in the downstream? But also, you've seen the Naira devalue quite a bit. Equally, you've seen oil prices plunge. How is it that you've managed to prevent the souring of asset quality in that book? And you're only attributing the increase in NPLs to the FX movement. The next question is on, we've seen that you had to restructure about 17% of your loans. I just wanted to understand where are they sitting? Are they still being classified as stage one? Or if we move to stage two, and I think this was asked earlier, you've seen your stage two loans increased by quite some quantum. And when I look at the growth in credit impairments, it's only up by about, I believe, the impairments only went up by about 74% year on year. So you see your loans, your stage two loans increase, and I'm assuming that means that you have to obviously work with lifetime losses as opposed to 12-month losses. So I'm just questioning why the increase in your cost of risk is not that significant, given that you've seen that significant jump in your stage two loans. And then just on your effective tax rate, just to get a sense of what is your projection of full year. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for those questions. I will invite Henry Oro to take on the question on the oil and gas loan book. The risk officer, our chief risk officer, Felix Egma, will speak on the restructured loan and on the effective tax. The CFO will take that. Henry, over to you.
Thank you so much, Mandy. Thank you for that question. For the oil and gas loans, a lot of the foreign currency exposure are in the areas of the upstream sector, and that is where a lot of the loans sit. And the issue about how vulnerable they are to prices for crude prices, the fact is that a lot of those companies in the oil and gas upstream sector, they have hedges in place, and most of them 8, 9, 10 months, 12 months hedges, and they are renewable before maturity. So with those hedges, we're able to mitigate the risk that happens when there's a downward swing in the price of crude. And like the MD said, we're also very optimistic that such swings don't go so low as to create a systemic problem in the industry. But from our observation of how this sector has played so far, and from the way we deal with the counterparties in the upstream sector, we are very confident that the hedges that were put in place will significantly and sufficiently mitigate against some unexpected drop in oil prices. So to answer your questions, a lot of the exposure in the foreign currency, exposure in the oil and gas, are in the upstream sector. But like I said, they are significantly mitigated by hedges.
Okay, thank you, Henry. So, Felix,
Speaking to your question on the restructuring as it relates to oil and gas, if you recall, oil and gas has been restructured some years back. The sector has been restructured based on the issues that are arising at that time. And if you well understand the steps that were taken at that time, you will recall that steps were taken to ensure that there were hedges in place, there were payment arrangements that allowed sculpturing. So performance based on that has been monitored all through this period. Now, the impact you have is what Mokta spoke about, which is the impact as relates to stage two listings that will arise from an increased risk environment, which is what may have thrown quite some of these classifications that we had before into more of the stage two. Mokta has spoken to that before about what is happening within the environment. Like I also mentioned earlier, negotiations are ongoing now among the syndicates on what they think will be the appropriate restructuring that will be suitable for Air and Gas. These discussions have not been concluded, but we don't expect a significant impact on our restructured position. So we are awaiting that.
Okay, thank you, Felix. So, Mukhtar, you take on the effective tax.
Okay, so effective tax rate, you're very right. The effective tax rate has gone down because the new Finance Act is being implemented, and under the new Finance Act, we don't pay tax, we are not paying tax strictly based on dividend provision. So if that is the case, the new Act gives you some room to reduce your dividend tax by certain expense that you use to generate those income. So the exempt income, you don't just exempt them straight. You are allowed to take some direct or indirect costs to reduce them. So with what is happening with the Finance Act, our effective tax rate is going to remain lower than what we have done last year. However, we during the beginning of the period, we guided 12% for the year. Half year effective tax rate was 9%. We are leaving the guidance at 12% because there are a lot of areas, gray areas in the implementation of the Act that are being clarified as we are moving on. So we have left our guidance at 12.5, but I'm not very sure we will hit that 12.5. You are asking for why cost of risk or impairment increased. Yes, cost of risk 1.8, we guided 1, and impairment has increased by 76%. So if I will decompose it for you, first, you will know that there is exchange rate movement. So all the loans that are dollar loans, if you are making 2% impairment charge on that loan, that same 2% impairment charge, the naira amount is going to be high. So that is number one. Number two, we have discussed the elevated risk environment. Whether a loan is bad or is not bad, the impairment you need for that particular loan is going to be higher than what you did last year. And all of us, our level of alertness on risk, everybody has increased, whether it is health risk or otherwise. So that is what is happening. That's number two. Number three, there are specific loans that have migrated from stage one to stage two and from stage two to stage three. Those have also attracted higher impairment charge. But if you put all these things together, is 1.8 cost of risk too high for this risk environment? I say no. I say it is more reflective of this environment that we are operating. And as we move into the second half of the year and all these restrictions are being removed and businesses are coming back to normal, we are going to see our cost of risk coming down. So we have guided 2% cost of risk for the end of the year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mukhtar. And
thank
let
you. I just want to say that actually I thought that 1.8 was quite low, and I was also mentioning the fact that you've seen a huge increase in your stage two loans. Yeah, it's true that that impairments have grown by about 6% year on year, but your cost of risk, probably looks a bit low. So the question is, despite this huge movement to stage two loans that you are seeing, the fact that you have to carry those as lifetime credit losses as opposed to 12 months, well, of course the interest will have been much higher. So I think that's what I was trying to allude to, as opposed to it being low.
Unfortunately, we are not too
audible. Should the impairment charge be higher?
Okay, your line
I'm
is
not audible. Apologies. Sorry, I was saying that we've seen the stage two loans increase by quite some quantum, and to our understanding is that normally, you know, when you move to stage two, you know how to carry lifetime credit losses. The question I'm asking is, my expectation is that you must see a much higher increase in the cost of risk than what you saw in quarter.
Okay,
I think if I heard you correctly, you talked about the fact that the stage two loan increased. Yeah. What you have is, like the CFO mentioned, we are in an environment where the risk level is elevated. And we don't want to live in denial by not recognizing it. We decided to toe the path of prudence to recognize that, yes, especially assets in the oil and gas sector that are vulnerable, we have to bring them into stage two. But hopefully, as the economy recovers and we see the price of crude rally, we should be able to, I mean, going forward, as the cash flows start coming, we'll be able to declassify them. It's essentially a risk management initiative that we have. It's in line with our conservative approach to risk management. We could have left them where they are, but we felt we needed to put ourselves on the, get ourselves to start looking at them very critically. I mean, we've seen the rally in the price of crude in the last 4 to 5 weeks, but suddenly in the last few days, we've seen a slump. You know, we've seen prices depressed as a result of the fact that there is the reported cases of second wave of the coronavirus pandemic in certain parts of the world. So like we say, we live in a moment of uncertainty. We don't really know what will happen, but we continue to be positive and not be pessimistic. But in that same space, it's important for us to recognize that, yes, these are the ones that are like the endangered species that we need to keep a close eye on. Not that they've deteriorated, as it were. For some of them, we are falling back on the forbearance given by the central bank for us to restructure. We haven't done anything outside that. And for most of them, repayment is up to date. And the important thing is that all these assets we have in the oil and gas space, in the last few years, we haven't added any new item. And the ones we have are all brownfield assets. You don't have any developmental or new appraisal assets or exploratory assets we are going. These are brownfield producing assets. And like Henry mentioned, for some of them, there are hedges in place, albeit the tenure may not be that long for obvious reasons, but at least we have like a rolling program that ensures that before the expiration of the existing one, we get something in place. And we head to the extent that based on the price deck, we can guarantee and assure ourselves of that minimum debt service obligation.
Okay, I think if you're trying to say that the growth in cost of risk is not proportional to the increase in the stage two loans, if that is your question, yes, it's not a straight line. When you are making provision, when you are looking at impairments, you have to look at a lot of things, including the collateral, valuation of the collateral, and other mitigants. So if you have very good collateral, remember, it's not going to stage three, so it's not a hardcore loan yet. So chances that you have very good collateral and the collateral values are good, so even though the entire loan has moved to stage three, you may not have significant increase in the required impairment based on the ECL model. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Can we take the next question?
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Wale Okrandi from Sigma Pensions. Please ask your question.
Okay, thank you for the presentation. My first question is on your derivatives losses. Can you sort of talk through what is driving those losses? As I see 13 billion this year, 13 billion last year. Can you just sort of explain what drove those losses? The currency, the interest rate, what exactly is driving those losses? My second question is on your electronic products. I see your earnings from that line is down. Can you sort of provide color or commentary on what exactly is going on there? Is it that you saw lower volumes or maybe most of the transactions, maybe called the bankers' tariff revisions? What exactly is going on there? Thirdly is, what's your effective lending rate or your average lending rate as at the end of H1? By how much has this dropped from where you were last year in basis points? Then I think also is on your stage two. What is driving the increase? So which sectors are driving the higher migration into stage two, into stage two loans, given the increases we've seen? What exactly is driving that? Yeah, and that will be all for me. Thank you.
thank you very much. I think I start from effective lending. It's difficult for me to give you an answer on my effective lending, because I have my customers in different segments, and the risk profile for them, they are quite different. So I don't have an average lending rate, but I price my asset, you know, is a one-on-one pricing. So, and again, the conditions are not, it's not a linear relationship. Therefore, it's difficult for me to tell you this is my average lending rate. But just be rest assured that our lending rate reflects the market effectively. We are competitive. Therefore, whatever the market dictates, that's how we price our asset, depending on the segment and who is involved. Markio, we deal with, if you look at our loan book, 80% of it is the top end of the market. So if we are at the top end of the market, one of the things you need to do is you have to be competitive with pricing. So that will give you an indication of what the pricing, the kind of pricing model will maintain. Electronic products, Tokwe already answered that, but we can explain it again. There's nothing strange happening. Instead, what we have in the electronic space is an interesting story. But that interesting story, the full impact is not being seen because of the huge impact of the regulated downward review of the relative fees and commission. And if you look at the fees and commission, the main revenue pool there is on the NIP. And if you look at the NIP too, the key drivers for us are the last year where we have almost a 75% downward reduction in the fees. We also have a situation where average card renewal fees, the monthly card renewal fees, is now reduced to quarterly. So quarterly, that's like another, call it 70, yeah, a reasonable percentage drop. So, but if you compare what we have drop in our electronic banking fees, which is about, I think about 40% thereabout, so, or 60%. So if you look at it compared to the average drop in terms of the guide to bank charges, you will see that average drop in terms of guide to bank charges, when we factor in everything, will give you about 70%. So if we assist, it means in effect, by reason of the growth that we have, the intensity of our drive in that space, we'll be able to cushion it. And we are also confident that as we close the year, we are going to see that we'll continue to close that gap by the sheer reason, by the sheer fact that our volumes are growing, intensity and velocity of our transaction in those space is also growing. So on stage three, I think we talked about the stage three loan. That's the stage two. We are just being prudent. We are just recognizing the fact that the environment we operated in last year is not the same today. We live in moments where your today and your tomorrow is now dramatically different from the past. So if that's the case where we don't know what is hitting us, there is no vaccine. And look at the way it is. In some locations, in some geographies of the world where we thought the pandemic is under control, we've seen the return of a second wave. These are extreme on certain times. The price of crude, like I said earlier, it rallied to 45, 46, but as we speak now, price of crude is struggling between $38 and $40. Even though commercial flights have resumed in and out of Nigeria, but it's not at that optimal level. So there are quite a lot of moving parts that we don't even know. This, like I said, we don't know the duration of travel. Therefore, we have to now sit back and be prudent to recognize that should there be an extreme situation, these are the sectors that will be impacted. That's simply what we've done. And as we move on, even for some of them, we've added, essentially the downstream oil and gas players where we had the legacy loans, those who did the importation of PMS, where government is now settling by issuance of promissory notes. What we did at the time of the audit was that because we hadn't received the promissory note, we decided to put all of them in stage two. We moved them away. We could have kept quiet and said, wait a minute, we already have promissory note, but we want to be prudent. Now, after the audit, we've seen the release of such promissory notes. The release of the promissory note, with that, we now declassify. So I think we are quite impressed with the way it is. It's not a sign of deterioration, but more of a sign of prudence and caution, an extreme and very conservative risk management approach to business.
That's who we are. That's who we are. We tend to push ourselves. Our standards in terms of what we do is usually above industry benchmark. Go and check in all situations. Our standards are above industry benchmark, which is what you've seen us display here. So going forward, hopefully as we close the year, you are going to see a reversal of some of these items showing a stronger performance. So that tomorrow, even if they get deteriorated, we are not panicked. We say, yes, we saw it coming. That's the kind of insight we like to provide with respect to the staging of the loans. On the derivative losses, I think these are normal mark-to-market issues. I'll leave the CFO to speak more to that.
Okay, thank you. So you're asking why we keep having derivative losses. So when you book swap transactions, the naira leg of the swap is sitting in treasury bills. So you have the income coming through treasury bills income. So if you look at page 149 of our financials, you see that we have mapped all of them together. Derivative loss, and then you have treasury bills trading income. So as the swap is pulling to par, then you have it coming through a loss. And then the gain on the treasury bills trading, which is the opposite leg, also moves up. So they are always compensating. So if you are saying that consistently you've been seeing derivative losses, you would also be consistently seeing treasury bills trading income that is moving almost at the opposite direction of the swap losses. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Can we take the next question?
Our next question comes from Wawai Oni from SBG Securities. Please go ahead with your question.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking the time to answer our questions and congratulations on the results. My name is Moira Oni. I have a few questions. I think the first is to elaborate on the hedging product you have in place for your oil and gas book. So if you could share the size of the hedge, so relative to the size of the book, what percentage is hedged? And then also if you could share price level and also maturity. I know you gave a range on the maturity, but if you could also share the price level. I think secondly, on your presentation pack on page 16, you talked about part of the drivers of the lower interest rate and lower yield on your asset, and you talked about rebalancing of interest generating assets. So I think if you could elaborate on what you mean by rebalancing as well, that will be helpful. Thirdly, your customer growth numbers have been quite strong. I think it's currently about 84%. So your new customers about 84% of your total 2019 additional customers. If you could share drivers of that growth. So has it been driven by agency banking and also profile of the customers as well? That would be helpful. And then the fourth question I have is just on the competitive landscape and what some of your peers are doing. Just wanted to get the sense of your views on, as an institution, exploring other non-banking financial services as an opportunity to expand and grow revenues. Those are my questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Muyiwa. The first question on hedging product price levels. First is that we don't have a straight line hedging instrument for all the assets. These are priced differently. But what we have that is unique to all of them is that in terms of the volume, we try to hedge the volume that we know is relative at the price level that can guarantee loan service. That's what we have. And there are different sophistication that come depending on who the obligor is. We've seen some cases where some have bought a straddle, they've instituted a straddle where they sell a put, and on the other side, they go and buy a call, just because they want to be sure that, yes, in the event that there is a pickup in price, they don't completely lose out. So it depends. In some cases, we've seen others who have just simply sold a put because they just want to cover the downside, which is what you see in most of them. Everybody is concerned about protecting
the downside. But for us, the important thing is the overriding objective for us is loan service. So if you give us a model that guarantees it, we are fine. If you decide now to say, yes, I want to, after doing that, I want to, you are concerned about subsequent rally. You don't want to lose that. That's where you start going to buy a call in return to do that. We haven't seen much of that. We saw that happen before, but it's just a few. But the trend we've seen is essentially selling puts. That's what the basic thing is. Price level, different. It depends on who is involved. In terms of volume level, it's dependent upon what we anticipate, depending on the price deck we've taken. Benchmark it against what we expect you will be. Apart from loan service, we have to make provision for your taxes and statutory payment and hedge payment. Once we have it, there is a coverage for that together with the debt service, we are fine. With maybe a little margin that will enable you continue to run the business. Customer growth driver. Zenith is a growth organization, and we will not stop growing. What we see is we are considered to be late entrant into the retail space. And anything we do, we give it our biggest might. We have announced our presence in the retail space. And what you can see, yes, part of the growth you see there is the intensity of our retail drive. It's difficult for me to give you the numbers, but just know that in all segments, we are growing. In all segments, even the retail, we are growing. And the growth is also being powered by the massive digital deployment we are doing. If you look at our OPEX, you are going to see that IT expense is high. IT expense is high because of the massive deployment that we have in digital technology. Like I said in my opening remarks, Shenzhen exchange is doing well. What's driving Shenzhen exchange? You, Alibaba. You talk of S&P 500. You talk of the tech companies. So commerce is going to, digital technology and e-commerce will continue to drive competitiveness going forward. And we are not missing words about it. We are committing to that massively. So what is really driving the growth we have in our business is our digital deployment. We've moved from the conventional stage of saying we have platform. Now we are at the stage where we are infusing machine learning and AI into different platforms. We are at that stage where we are also mining data. We can mine our data that can enable us exclusively communicate and send the right communication to different customers. We don't need to send generic information. We can tell our customer journey by just mining your data. So these are things that we are leveraging, and we are seeing the quantum leap, and we expect that to continue. That speaks to a competitive landscape. We are never scared to compete. We got to where we are by competing. If you remember, Zenith, we are just 30 years. There are other institutions much older than us, so which means at the time we started, we were at the bottom of the pyramid. But today, we are where we are by competing. And the competition is not just, the competition is also internal. You see, you have a system that is very competitive where each one, there is a healthy competition to outdo each other. And there is an enormous reward for outstanding performance. So we can't stop that culture. That's part of our DNA. If anybody tries to stop it, the system won't even allow you to stop it. Therefore, in terms of competition, it depends on what the market presents. Will we compete? Are we looking at maybe some corporate actions? We've always maintained that it all depends on what we see. If we find something that is disciplined, if we find something that fits into our culture, if we find something that aligns with our strategic intent, we'll be interested. We are not going to be carried away by managerial hubris of people are doing things, we want to do it. We will do it because it makes sense and it makes money. So we'll just leave it open, but just be rest assured that we are quite open, we are dynamic, we are nimble, we are looking at things as they evolve, and if there is need for us to make a move on anything, we'll make a move. If we find anything strategically important that's relevant, we will respond accordingly. You talked about what else have I not taken? Lower yield on asset and rebalancing of interest. CFO will throw more light on it.
Okay. Thank you, Moiwa. So if you look at the same page you are making reference to, the slide 16, we have shown the breakdown of our income. Loans and advances, 128 from 115, grew by 12%. Income from treasury bills dropped by 46%. Income from government and other bonds grew by 20%. So, So that's what we mean by rebalancing. We all know the treasury bills rate have not been very, very good. So we need to move to higher yielding areas. If you look at our balance sheet, you realize that investment in securities increased on the balance sheet. Loans and advances increased. And if you look at the breakdown of the income from each of these lines, they have all increased. Our balance sheet, if you look at it again, you will see that treasury bills have dropped. So the income from treasury bills again have dropped. That's what we mean by rebalancing.
Well, put in another context, what you see reflects the current yield environment. So it's not anything different from what the market situation is. Can we take the next question?
Our next question comes from Ebele Ejiofor from Benin Bank, Nigeria. Please go ahead with your question. Ebele Ejiofor from Benin Bank, please go ahead with your question. Okay. We'll move on to the next participant. Next participant is Solki Zalanka from Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi everyone. I just have a few follow-up questions. So the first one is, for your treasury bill portfolio, could you perhaps shed some color? What's the split between trading EFS and held to maturity? And what is the policy around movement across categories? My second question is also around the trading book. So if I got you correctly, any gain you have from valuations is unrealized and will cycle out if the treasury bills mature, except you sell them, which basically means in this environment, your NIMs should take a hit once you've sold, as the accrued interest must drop off. So help me understand what happens when these bills mature or you sell them and realize the gains but reinvest at lower rates. So just help me understand what's happening there. My third question is, if you can just take a step back on stage two loans, at a half year, what are the key sectors that make up what you have in stage two? Then my last two questions, you have something called electronic card receivables, which increased from 42 billion to 83.5 billion at group level. So if I'm not mistaken, you know, the card transactions are already paid for by the customer in Naira. So what will clear the receivable? Or what exactly are these receivables in the first place? And then my final question is, what FX rate have you used to revalue your book for the FX revaluation gains you've reported? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Soji. I will take on the issue of the stage two loan. Let me repeat what I said, that what we decided to do was to recognize the fact that risk profile globally is elevated. And as the pandemic affects Nigeria, one of the sectors that is hard hit is oil and gas. So, I mean, we have sectors like entertainment, tourism, and hospitality, but transport, but we don't have exposure in terms of tourism, aviation, and hospitality. So we look at the oil and gas space and recognize that, yes, if things get worse, this will be the sector that will be heavily impacted. So as a result, what you have there is the increase you have in the stage two, they are largely driven by those oil and gas assets that we brought in there. And Again, we also have some of the legacy PMS import transaction of 2016-2017 times that the federal government is now settling with promissory notes. As at half-year audit, we decided that the prudent thing for us to do will be let's put them in situ. As we receive the promissory note, we declassify them. And as we speak now, for some of them, we've received the promissory notes. We just got them dematerialized. So going forward, you are going to see a declassification by the time we do the full year. That explains the stage two. Treasury bills, the HTM and the trading book, I think Mukta has spoken to it. I'll get him to go through that again. I'm referring to the numbers in the audited financials. The same thing goes for the electronic card receivables. These are essentially transit items, which Mukta will also throw more light on. Then FS rate, Mukta will take that as well.
Okay, so the FX rate that we use is NAFEX. As of June, it was 386. That's number one. Number two, you are talking of gain on revaluation that will be realized or unrealized. So your trading book, you don't do accrual on the trading book. The trading book you can buy a treasury bill today and sell it today. You buy a treasury bills and today you sell it tomorrow, you buy a new one. So it's a complete trading book. At the point that you are getting, you buy everything, the fair value is what you bring into your books. And when you are disposing it off, your cost of disposal is the fair value that is sitting in the book minus what the proceeds or the consideration you have received. So there is the trading book is not run on an accrual basis, right? It's on valuation basis. That's number two. The third one, you mentioned T-bills portfolio, AFS, HTM. Classification into AFS, HTM is based on old IFRS 9. The new IFRS 9 that we are using, there is no classification called AFS, HTM. It's trading or non-trading. Once you designate them as trading, you will fair value. If you designate them as held to maturity, you will carry them at amortized cost. So it's either you are doing fair value or you are doing amortized cost. So you ask movement, on what conditions would you move between classes? The standard shows clearly how you can move from one class to another. It's not based on number of days or volume. It's purely based on your business model. Is driven by your business model. At the time that you are getting, what is the business model that you are running? Our business model is that we have a banking book and we have a trading book. The trading items are sitting in the trading book. What is sitting in the banking book? We have some that we are holding. When we have need for liquidity, you can always sell to meet your liquidity, which the standard also permits and allows. Okay? I've mentioned rate. Electronic card receivable. The amount is high because of the high volume of transaction and it's receivable from other parties, either other banks or fintechs or all of them. But if you go to page 174 of the financial, you would also see payables relating to some of those transactions. So you have one that we call electronic card related payable and other payable. So if you look at it net-net, we have payables and we have receivable. That reflects the huge volume of digital or electronic transactions within the system. And it also reflects the share of our business within that space. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Can we take on the next question?
Thank you. Just as a reminder again, if you wish to ask an audio question, you may do so by pressing 01 on your telephone keypad. Again, it's 01 on your telephone keypad if you wish to ask an audio question. Our next question comes from Jerry Numbwe from Cardinal Stone. Please go ahead with your question.
Thank you. I just have a couple of follow-up questions. The first one is on your fee. So I understand the movements or the cost, you know, for the decline in fee income across board. But your fee expense is increasing. So I'm not seeing that same correlation. It's not the same story. Fee expense increased about 74%. So what's happening there? I would have envisioned the same story would have impacted that, so that would have declined during the period. So what's happening there? The second is, speaking to hedges and protections for credit, do you employ CDSs and credit default swaps? And if you do, have they been of any benefit for you during the period? Those are my questions. Thank you.
Okay. Let me get Dennis to answer that question.
Thank you very much. On the issue of increase in our electronic fees, I just want to draw attention to the fact that some of these fees have international components, which means that they are foreign exchange based. We do a lot of transactions using MasterCard as well as MasterCard. Sometimes they are cross-border transactions, and the fees are normally taken in dollars. So if there is a devaluation in currency, it does give you an exacerbation in the absolute amount when you translate them in naira.
All right, thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. There appears to be no further questions, so I'll hand back to the speakers for any other remarks.
Okay, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a pleasure to have the opportunity to explain to you the dynamics of the business and how Zenith Bank is weathering the storm. We'd like to say that the outlook still remains extremely uncertain. But however, we are in an environment where, as it were, we've seen people, the early shock that greeted the pandemic is now being replaced with a lot more of caution and optimism. And we are riding on this optimism to ensure that businesses are open. Zenith Bank will continue to adhere to the protocol of the health authorities. We'll continue to maintain social distancing, and we'll continue to ensure that we protect the health and safety of our staff, which is our most precious asset. And we also ensure that access into the premises, we continue to regulate it in line with the guidance of the health authorities. So going towards the close of the year, we expect that we'll continue to adhere to our very strict risk management principles. We don't anticipate that there will be a deterioration in our risk assets. So far, the dispensation we've enjoyed that CBN provided, we haven't seen any standstill situation with respect to how the loan book is standing. There has not been any deferred, there have not been any defaults. We'll continue to accelerate our business model with our electronic and digital deployment. We have been deliberate about it. We are also comprehensive to ensure that every aspect of our operations are covered. So we expect to have an acceleration in this agile environment to cruise and end the year on a good note. To that extent, the key guidance for the year, we think we'll achieve it. It's going to be hard, no doubt. It's going to be difficult, but we are staying true to our culture of hard work and focus and determination to ensure that, yes, we achieve the guidance that we have earlier advised to the market. We also ensure that we reward shareholders who have continued to be patient, investors who are patient and believe in us, and continue to entrust their investments and their resources in us. We will ensure that, yes, even with the pandemic, that they are not left empty-handed. We will reward them, which inform the decision for the board approving a dividend of 30 kobo per share. So we are definitely certain that we'll be able to contend with whatever situation we face in the market, because Zenith as an institution, one thing we have is that we do a lot of learning, we do a lot of thinking, and as a result, we build different scenarios. We get even to the stage of being paranoid. And to that extent, we are able to build different scenarios that will enable us to adjust and respond to whatever the market presents. So I thank you very much and look forward to a very impressive year end. We'll continue to urge everyone, ensure you mask up while in public, maintain social distancing, make sure you wash your hands regularly, because together we can only help in fighting the pandemic. Even if there is no vaccine, let's help to contain the spread. Thank you very much, and God bless you, and continue to keep safe.
This now concludes our conference call. Thank you all for attending. You may now disconnect your lines.